Today is Wednesday, October 22nd, 2025, and you're listening to the World Socialist website. Trump builds himself a Versailles on the Potomac. By Patrick Martin. On Monday, excavators began tearing through the east wing of the White House, beginning the construction of a monstrosity that symbolizes the fascist presidency of Donald Trump, a $200 million, 90,000 square foot White House ballroom financed by Trump's billionaire donors. The demolition of the east wing of the White House marks a grotesque milestone in the decay of American democracy. The seat of the American presidency is being physically transformed into the architectural embodiment of oligarchic rule. According to renderings released by the administration, the new hall will be drenched in gold, chandeliers, gilded Corinthian columns, coffered ceilings, marble floors, a monument to wealth, greed, and cultural vulgarity. The East Wing has been, since its construction during the administration of Franklin Delano Roosevelt, the most popular aspect of the residence of the American president. For decades, it was open to public tours for which visitors, frequently school children, could queue up without making a reservation. After the 9/11 attacks, new security measures restricted the number of visitors and required pre-registration. But it is still the case that 500,000 visitors toured the East Wing last year. Now, what had been the most accessible part of the White House complex will be turned over to the financial oligarchy. The new ballroom, Trump boasted Tuesday, will accommodate 1,000 people, five times the East Room's capacity, allowing for even larger banquets for the super rich. Trump reportedly complained that the current space was too small for the fundraising dinners he holds for his billionaire friends, the gangsters and oligarchs, who finance both the Republican Party and Trump personally. The White House, while built in part by slave labor, has been occupied by Adams, Jefferson, Lincoln, Grant, figures identified with the democratic traditions of the American Revolution and the fight against slavery, and the reaction in the Civil War. Now its East Wing is being rebuilt as part of Trump's Versailles, a palace for the oligarchy erect atop the ruins of American democracy. In the decades before the French Revolution, Versailles became synonymous with corruption, aristocratic luxury, and decay. Trump's project evokes the same spirit, the attempt by a dying social order to immortalize its power through gilded excess. The Versailles on the Potomac will serve as the venue for high society galas, meeting with billionaires, and celebrations of military power. It is the physical manifestation of a government of, by, and for the rich. The administration's defenders have insisted that private donations absolve the project of any scandal. But that is the essence of corruption. The purchasing of access to public power by private interest. Trump boasted this week that there were no zoning conditions and that he could do anything he wanted. "This is the White House," he said he was told. "You're the President of the United States. You can do anything you want." Trump, like Louis XIV, the builder of Versailles, embraced the credo, "L'État c'est moi." I am the state. Although in the bureaucratic jargon of the 2025 project, this is translated into English as the unitary executive. The original planners of the U.S. Capitol, however, having passed through the furnace of the American Revolution, deliberately located the Capitol, the seat of the legislator, on the highest available hill, where it would tower over the residence of the executive. There are other elements of fascist grandiosity in Trump's plans for Washington, D.C. He is reportedly planning to build a huge arch near Arlington National Cemetery, also to be funded by donations from oligarchs and corporations. At a meeting last week with several dozen billionaire supporters, he held up a model of the Ark, topped with a gold Statue of Liberty. "It's going to be very beautiful. I think it will be fantastic," he declared. There are, of course, elements of dementia and self-glorification in such plans. The Ark is already being described sarcastically as the Arc de Trump, playing off its resemblance to the Arc de Triomphe built in Paris on the orders of Napoleon. But Hitler, too, had such notions. He worked with Albert Speer on plans to build a triumphal arch in Berlin, said to be more than twice the height of the French monument. The collapse of the Third Reich ended that endeavor. The destruction of the East Wing and its replacement with a palace ballroom symbolizes a broader process. The systematic erasure of the democratic ideals upon which the United States was founded. It coincides with Trump's moves to invoke the Insurrection Act, to deploy the military domestically, to criminalize opposition, and to elevate his family and inner circle to positions of power. The renovation of the White House is inseparable from the reconstruction of the state along dictatorial lines. But far from being an expression of strength, these developments expose weakness and fear. The American oligarchy, mired in social inequality, financial parasitism, and endless war, can no longer rule through democratic means. It must instead rely on gold-plated palaces, propaganda, and brute force to maintain its crumbling legitimacy. Trump's ballroom is being built not out of confidence in the future, but out of dread of the masses. A White House spokesman responded to the massive October 18th No Kings protest, in which more than 7 million people participated, with a peremptory dismissal. "Who cares?" Trump himself called the protest a joke, describing them as very small, very ineffective, while vilifying the demonstrators as whacked out. But even in this administration, there is a tacit acknowledgement of the intensifying popular anger. On Monday, the Treasury Department, whose headquarters is adjacent to the White House, giving a clear view of the East Wing demolition, instructed workers not to share photos of the project on social media, while claiming this was for security reasons. The danger was not from a foreign enemy, but from the enemy within, as Trump would put it. Trump and his fascist aides may be blind, but the financial oligarchy as a whole sensed the danger when, on the same day, headlines announced that billionaires are spending $200 million to build a huge new addition to the White House, and that 154,000 schoolchildren in New York City are homeless, with nearly 65,000 of them living in shelters. As Versailles stood for the ancient regime, so too will Trump's White House renovation stand for a degenerate ruling class whose time is running out, and which faces a social revolution that will take its place in the great historical line from the French Revolution of 1789 and the Russian Revolution of 1917. Australian Labour PM fawns on fascist Trump at the White House, by Mike Head. Just 3 days after millions of people took to the streets of the United States in No Kings demonstrations against the fascistic Trump administration drive towards dictatorship, Australian Prime Minister Anthony Albanese lauded Trump at a White House meeting yesterday. Albanese not only hailed and solidarized himself with Trump, he declared that the Labour government was taking the 70-year post-World War II alliance with U.S. imperialism to the next level by signing a critical minerals agreement aimed at preparing for a U.S.-led war against China. At the White House Cabinet Room event, both Trump and Albanese went out of their way to praise each other, even though it was the first face-to-face meeting that Albanese had been able to secure with Trump. Albanese had been desperately seeking one since Trump's return to office in January and has repeatedly refused to publicly comment on, let alone criticize, his fascistic policies. Behind the mutual public backslapping, the meeting signaled accelerating plans to further transform Australia into a platform for a US-led war against China, including the supply of military-related rare earths, the processing of which China currently dominates globally. Albanese congratulated Trump on his so-called Middle East peace deal, telling him it was an extraordinary achievement. That backing came amid renewed Israeli bombings and killings in Gaza, and further exposed the neo-colonial character of the White House's plan to impose an occupation on the Palestinian population. In return, Trump described Albanese as highly respected and doing a fantastic job. In front of cameras, Trump told him, "We've been long-term, long-time allies, and I would say there's never been anybody better. We fought wars together, and we never had any doubts. It's a great honor to have you as my friend, and a great honor to have you in the United States of America." End quote. Trump praised Albanese for his May federal election victory, and declared that the multi-billion dollar AUKUS military pact against China was going full steam ahead, with the production of nuclear-powered attack submarines, despite still being under a prolonged Pentagon review. "We have it all set with Anthony," Trump said. Trump also played down, for now, his administration's demands for a far greater military spending by the Australian government. He described the Labor government's already rising level of spending as great, but I'd always like more. The centerpiece of the stage-managed event was the signing of a framework on critical minerals and rare earths. Under the deal, the two governments said they would invest in or subsidize up to $8.5 billion in new mines and processing plants. They would also offer guaranteed price floors or similar measures for new producers and block mine sales on national security grounds. All these moves are directed against China. In a media statement, Albanese described the agreement as an historic elevation of the U.S. military alliance, on which Australian governments have relied since World War II. He said it would, quote, "deliver a U.S.-Australia secured supply chain for critical minerals and rare earths, required for defense and other advanced technologies. This represents a significant new chapter in the over 70 years of our formal alliance," end quote. The framework consists of identifying and subsidizing priority projects, particularly related to the supply of rare minerals needed for jet engines, military weaponry, and other high-tech equipment, including smartphones and electric vehicles. Within 6 months, both governments would take steps to provide at least $1 billion in financing to projects located in each of the United States and Australia. End quote. In addition, the Export-Import Bank of the United States would contribute around $2.2 billion, expected to be matched by $5 billion in corporate investment. Albanese said his government already had two projects ready to go. The first was a $200 million government investment in Alcosojitz Gallium Recovery Project in Western Australia. His office said the project would provide up to 10% of the total global supply of gallium, an essential input for defense and semiconductor manufacturing. Secondly, the Labor government would take $100 million stake in the Arafura Nolans rare earths mining project in the Northern Territory, which was projected to produce 5% of global rare earths. The project, which is backed by billionaire Gina Rinehart Hancock Prospecting, has already received more than $1 billion in government commitments. In reality, such mining and processing projects cost billions of dollars to develop. Even the headline package of $8.5 billion will hardly overcome China's domination of an estimated 90% of the processing capacity of some rare earths. But the Trump administration is aggressively seeking to close that gap as an essential requirement for a war against China. As if to underscore that intent, the event with Albanese included Vice President J.D. Vance, Secretary of State Marco Rubio, War Secretary Pete Hegseth, Chief of Staff Susie Wiles, and Interior Secretary Doug Burgum. Under the agreement, the U.S. and Australian governments have pledged to speed up mining and processing projects' approvals by deregulating and slashing red tape. In the language of the framework, quote, "The participants are taking measures to accelerate, streamline, or deregulate permitting timelines and processes, including to obtain permits for critical minerals and rare earths mining, separation, and processing." End quote. A U.S.-Australian Critical Mineral Supply Security Response Group is being established under the leadership of the U.S. Energy Secretary and the Australian Resources Minister to, quote, "identify priority minerals and supply vulnerabilities." Since taking office in 2022, the Albanese government already has intensified the AUKUS-related commitments made by the previous Liberal National Coalition government with the Biden administration. In particular, it has stepped up the U.S. military's access to air and military bases across northern Australia and begun expanding naval facilities as logistical hubs for U.S. nuclear submarines. Trump specifically praised Australia's record in building, quote, "magnificent holding pads for the submarines." In the lead-up to the White House meeting, Albanese sought to further prove his government's worth as a partner of U.S. imperialism by seeking to impose treaties on South Pacific countries to bar military or police agreements with China, culminating in an Australian military pact with Papua New Guinea. Despite all these efforts, however, the Trump administration may demand much more. Asked by reporters, Trump ruled out providing any relief from punishing U.S. tariffs, which remain at 10% for all Australia exports to America, plus 50% on steel and aluminum. The critical minerals and rare earths framework itself is not set in stone. It, quote, "does not constitute or create any legally binding or enforceable obligations," end quote. Moreover, U.S. Navy Secretary John Fallon, who was also at the meeting, flagged changes to the AUKUS treaty, which includes the U.K. These could involve a higher submarine purchase price than the $368 billion allocated by the previous coalition government. At the White House event, the current Australian ambassador to Washington, former Prime Minister Kevin Rudd, personally apologized to Trump for comments he had posted on social media in 2020, after Trump lost that year's presidential election. Rudd had labeled Trump the most destructive president in U.S. history. Rudd's apology to the would-be dictator was another embodiment of Labor's dedication to intensifying Australian imperialism's alliance with Washington and commitment to a U.S.-led war with China. Rudd himself was removed from office in 2010 by U.S. protected sources inside the Labor Party after he suggested that the Obama administration could make some accommodation to the rise of China as an economic power in the Indo-Pacific region. For the past 15 years, the Labor Party, in government and in opposition, has been fully in support of the accelerating U.S.-led drive to war against China that Obama initiated with his pivot to Asia. Since coming to office, the Trump administration has repeatedly made clear it is accelerating preparations for conflict with the world's second-largest economic power, a fact that is underscored by yesterday's meeting with the Australian Prime Minister. Everett, Massachusetts. Lawyers group calls for state probe into police role in ICE detention of 13-year-old by Mike Ingram. Lawyers for Civil Rights, LCR, is calling for a state investigation after police detained a 13-year-old Brazilian child who was then abducted by U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, ICE, and transferred 500 miles away to a detention center in Virginia. Seventh grader Arthur Berto was arrested by Everett police at a bus stop outside the Albert N. Parlin School after a tip about him reportedly threatening another student, according to the police. the boy's mother, Josie Alberto, was told to pick up her son at the police station, but after waiting for more than an hour, she was informed that ICE agents had arrived and taken the boy into federal custody. LCR sent an open letter to Governor Mara Healey, Attorney General Andrea Joy Campbell, and Interim Secretary at the Executive Office of Public Safety and Security, Susan Terry. It urges the Commonwealth to, quote, take decisive steps to protect youth in custody, the letter states. Lawyers for Civil Rights is deeply concerned about the role of the Everett Police Department in the recent detention and transfer of a 13-year-old child to ICE custody. This troubling incident underscores a broader pattern of escalating immigration enforcement in Massachusetts and calls for the Commonwealth's immediate investigation into potential violations of well-established precedent under Lunn v. Commonwealth. The letter said that while facts were unfolding, Everett police had violated legal restrictions. It stated, the fact that the boy's mother was notified that she should come to the police station to take her son home strongly suggests that police at that point were no longer authorized to continue to hold him in custody. Yet when she had arrived at the police station, there was an hour-long delay, and then her son was taken by ICE. It appears that Everett police transferred custody of the boy directly to ICE, rather than releasing him as Lunn would require. End quote. The press report on the LCR website quotes Jillian Lenson, senior staff attorney at LCR. Quote, this chilling incident exposes what may be a dangerous breakdown in legal protection for immigrants in our state, and the fact that it involves a child makes it even more alarming. Another staff attorney, Brooke Simone, wrote, quote, this kind of conduct destroys public trust and strikes fear in entire communities. In Massachusetts, it's not just wrong, it's unlawful. According to LCR, quote, local police cannot prolong someone's detention or assist ICE in making an arrest. End quote. While Everett police denied having collaborated with ICE, Police Chief Paul Strong revealed that they had done precisely that when he described the department's procedures. Quote, once your fingerprints are taken, it goes to ICE, and they determine if you're an illegal entry. End quote. This standard booking process is automatically allowing ICE to seize people with no due process. LCR is demanding an investigation to, quote, determine whether Everett police officers unlawfully extended Berto's custody to facilitate an ICE arrest. End quote. The Everett events demonstrate the fraudulent character of sanctuary cities, promoted by the Democratic Party as a bulwark against federal overreach. These designations are politically worthless, providing a progressive cover for a state apparatus that continues to collude with federal agencies in the persecution of the working class. While politicians posture, the police, who form the armed core of the capitalist state, continue to function as a pipeline for the federal government's anti-immigrant terror campaign. This brutal collaboration is not an aberration, but a feature of the nationwide crackdown on the immigrant population. Operation Patriot 2.0 is the latest escalation in the Trump administration's war on immigrant workers in Massachusetts. Its strategic purpose is to terrorize immigrant communities, whip up xenophobia, and divide the working class by scapegoating a vulnerable population for the deepening social crisis created by capitalism. An October 16 press release from ICE stated that 1,400 arrests were made in Massachusetts in the first month of Patriot 2.0 in September. While federal authorities present this as a precision strike against violent criminals, documented cases from across the state show the indiscriminate attack on immigrants. Right-wing politicians justify these police state roundups by claiming they target dangerous criminals. The case of Everett teen Arthur Berto made national headlines and is a high-profile example of the broad reach of the operation. Across the state, other detentions show a clear pattern of targeting that includes asylum seekers with legal status, community activists, and workers with no criminal history. While the Trump administration spearheads the current brutal offensive, its policies are the culminations of a decades-long bipartisan war on immigrant workers. The groundwork for today's mass deportations and militarized border was laid by Democratic and Republican administrations alike, demonstrating that both corporate-controlled parties are united in their defense of the capitalist state and its repressive policies. Another example of the assault on immigrants is the case of Isanula Garay, a 38-year-old Afghan national with brain cancer who was arrested on September 14th in Methuen, Massachusetts, and then transferred to an ICE facility in Georgia. Garay fell ill a couple of years ago after his doctoral studies in New York. Last winter, he moved to Lowell, Massachusetts to be closer to a local family member and his radiation therapy appointments at Boston Medical Center. According to Garay's lawyers, when he entered ICE custody, he was well enough to stand, but is now using a wheelchair. Garay got lost while working as a food delivery driver and stopped to ask directions for what he thought was a police officer, but who turned out to be an ICE agent, who arrested him for an expired student visa. According to Garay's lawyers, Hans Bremer, Garay has exceptionally strong asylum claim. Bremer told WBUR, "He's doing everything correctly that we have always required for somebody who wants to seek asylum." End quote. Robin Nice, former chair of the American Immigration Lawyers Association of New England, told WBUR, "Garay's case reflects how the Trump administration's immigration agenda has reshaped detention policies." "Where's the accountability?" Nice asked. "Who's to say they can't transfer someone to like 5 different detention centers and effectively make posting bond impossible?" End quote. You can find all this and more at the World Socialist website, wsws.org. This has been Archie Stone for the World Socialist website.
The World Socialist website is published by the International Committee of the Fourth International, the ICFI, the leadership of the World Socialist Movement, the Fourth International founded by Leon Trotsky in 1938. The World Socialist website relies entirely on the donations of readers and listeners for financial support. To give to the WSWS or to set up a regular monthly contribution, go to wsws.org/donate. We urge our listeners to join the International Committee of the Fourth International and one of its affiliated political parties and take up the struggle for socialism.